just a dream. Just a dream I had on my mind.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's episode, we trace the history of Chicago blues, especially blues harmonica, and its role in the birth of rock and roll with our guest Kim Field, writer, musician, and co-author of the book The Blues Dream of Billy Boy Arnold. Born in Chicago in 1935, William Arnold, better known as Billy Boy, started playing blues harmonica professionally as a teenager. His career spans over 8 decades, in which he's met and performed with many of the greats, including Sonny Boy Williamson, Little Walter, Bo Diddley, Muddy Waters, Howling Wolf, Otis Rush, Otis Spann, Elmore James, Jimmy Reed, James Cotton, Paul Butterfield, and Charlie Musselwhite. And his songs have been recorded by rock groups like the Yardbirds, with Eric Clapton on guitar, and the Animals. Billy Boy is still with us at the age of 87, and still playing the blues. After seeing him perform at Seattle's Jazz Alley in 2015, Kim was inspired to do a book on Billy Boy's life and music. A few years later, Kim pitched the idea to Billy Boy himself, and they sat down over the next 1.5 years to record over 60 hours of interviews. The result is The Blues Dream of Billy Boy Arnold, a memoir told entirely in Billy Boy's own words, painstakingly transcribed by Kim from those tapes. As Kim writes in the book's introduction, Billy Boy's memory is nothing short of phenomenal. He possesses an encyclopedic recall. I think you'll find, as we're transported back to the Chicago of the 50s and 60s and the early days of rock, both here and in England, that Billy Boy is as spellbinding a storyteller as he is a musician. Please join us for our conversation with Kim Field, which is already in progress. Kim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, Ken, thank you. The pleasure's all mine. Thanks.
Now, I've read and listened to several of your interviews for The Blues Dream of Billy Boy Arnold, and they usually start with the book's origin story, and we'll get to that. But I'd like to start with a little about your origin story. You're a musician, a harmonica player like Billy Boy. What first attracted you to the instrument?
Well, I played trumpet all through school, like from fourth grade through high school. And then at the end of high school, I was kind of looking around for another instrument. And, you know, I looked at guitar, and that seemed pretty complicated. I had a bluegrass phase, and I looked at banjos, but I'm left-handed, so I would have to have a custom-made banjo. And then I went to the big rock hall at the time in Seattle. This is the late 60s, was Eagles Auditorium, which is now the ACT Theater in downtown. It's in 7th and Union. It's in downtown Seattle. And they had all the big rock shows. So the circuit on the West Coast was kind of like the Whiskey A Go-Go in L.A., the Fillmore in San Francisco, Portland.
The Paramount maybe here in
Portland. Yeah, Eagles Auditorium in Seattle. And then there was a venue up in Vancouver too. So we kind of got the Fillmore shows a little later, you know, like a few days later. And so that was the height of the blues revival. So I think the first show I ever went to was the Byrds. And I just, Eagles Auditorium was such an eye-opening experience for a bunch of us suburban Seattle kids. We were like, we're here every weekend. We didn't care who was playing. And the next show I saw was Albert King. And I didn't really know anything about blues, but he kind of ripped the top of my head off. And,
what an introduction to the music.
Oh, yeah. It was unbelievable. Then soon after that, I saw James Cotton. So, you know, I'm a trumpet player, so I'm pretty oriented to wind instruments. And Cotton had a fantastic band in those days with Luther Tucker on guitar, used to play with Little Walter, and Francis Clay on drums used to be with Muddy. It was just an incredible show. And Cotton was playing harmonica through an amplifier. And I had heard Butterfield by that point, but James Cotton he just stunned me. He did a slow blues instrumental, and I was like, how is he doing that? Like, that's the most beautiful sound I have ever heard. And like, it's a harmonica. Like, that's just insane. And so I went down to the music store and bought a C harmonica the next day and started flailing. And I've been flailing ever since.
Well, just like Billy Boy. I mean, you started the same way.
Yeah.
Your first book, which came out, I think, initially in the 90s and then was released in 2000, updated, Harmonicas, Harps, and Heavy Breathers, which is a history of the instrument in a bunch of genres, not just the blues. You write, devoid of keys, valves, strings, mouthpiece, or any other visible clue to its mysteries, the harmonica confounds the uninitiated. So it doesn't look as complicated, like you said, the guitar, but it's not a simple instrument by any means. That early flailing, how did you start making music?
I don't remember exactly. I was, the thing that's interesting now is that there was, today there are just hours and hours and hours and hours of really high quality instructional material on the harmonica. When I started in 68, there was one book by a guy named Tony Little Son Glover that we all had that was really not very effective as a teaching tool. And some of it was actually wrong. But, you know, I just started playing by ear. And there's actually a really big advantage, I think, about doing it that way, which is the way we all did it back then. And it really does educate your ear. We're talking about the diatonic harmonica, which is the one everybody knows, the small 10-hole version. There's also a chromatic harmonica, which is larger and has a button to get incidentals, sharps and flats. You play an F and then you push the button in and you get an F sharp. So you can literally learn to read music on the chromatic and, you know, just like any other instrument. And many, many people have done that. And there's been phenomenal classical players and jazz players and everything. But on the diatonic harmonica, you're mostly switching keys a lot. You know, you're switching harmonicas to play in different keys. So it's not really feasible to learn to read music on it. And learning by ear was really valuable in a lot of ways. It was super hard and I wasted time and going down dead ends and so forth. But, and then I would meet these players and their attitude was like, I had to work to learn all this. Why would I show you this?
Wow. Like, not very generous.
Well, no, but I mean, again, it forced me to learn by ear, which was a good thing. And I went, and going through that struggle it's not as perverse as it sounds. There's big benefits to it. So I'm just boggled today at the scene with all the instructional materials available. It's just, it would have saved me a hell of a lot of time. There's no doubt about it. I'm glad I learned to play by ear because in the end, all harmonic players do that. But, the harmonica was invented in the 1820s, right at the, it's a cousin of the concertina and the accordion. They're all based on the same principle called a free reed. And they all came out for better or for worse in the 1820s. There are actually, I mentioned in the harmonica book, there are stories of angry citizenry in different European cities collecting all the harmonicas and accordions and burning them in giant bonfires.
Right? Why was that?
Well, it's not everybody's favorite sound.
Let's that's a little drastic.
I don't have any accordion records.
No, that's true. I don't.
The harmonica was built to be a self-accompanied little band in your pocket to play and it doesn't even have the diatonic. Is it diatonic? Because it just has a diatonic scale, which means it doesn't have all the notes built into it. And the diatonic scale is the basis of most folk songs, most simple melodies. So, and it was a German instrument. So it was meant to play like. If you hear, I'm using I'm playing the melody out of one side of my mouth and using the tongue up and down on the harp to get that backbeat and dot, 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 dot. So that's the way it went for a long, long time. And it wasn't meant to be played with other instruments really or anything. And but then the harmonica made its way to the United States. And sometime around the you know, in probably the turn of the century, early 20th century. It was a popular instrument in the rural South because, again, it was cheap. And you can get it through the Sears catalog. You know, they were 10 cents maybe or something. And so rural Americans got a hold of it, white and black musicians. And the first thing in those days, if you were a harmonica player, you had to have a really great train imitation and a fox and hounds imitation. That was like, those were the two crucibles that every harp player had to go through. And if you wanted to show that you were really a harmonica player, you had to be able to do a killer train and a killer fox and hounds chase. That oompa music I just played is based on the blow note scale. This is an A harp, so that's an A scale. So that little oompa thing was in the key of A. But the train whistle works best on the draw notes. The train whistle is kind of like...
Right.
If you listen closely, the note is bent at the beginning and the end. Because of the train, I think. This is just my theory. Harp players begin to look at the draw notes. And the draw scale, which is... That happens on an A harp. That happens to be an E. So they started playing in the key of E on an A harp instead of the key of A. And that became known as cross harp or second position. And there are other positions too. There's, theoretically there's 12, but effectively there's three or four. There's another position, third position, which works well. It gives you a minor kind of sound. So it works really great for keys and songs in minor keys. But it was the bent note that got people from the train whistle. But those notes are not built into the harmonica. Matthias Hohner, the head of the Hohner Company, and the guys who built the original instruments had no idea that this was even possible. And I learned, actually, because I wrote the book, I had to learn a lot about how the instrument works. I was pretty ignorant about it. When you bend a note on a draw note, you're bending down. I thought you pull the reed into a different lower position and to make it play a different note. But actually, there's two rows of reeds on a harmonica, one on one side and one on the other side, and one's for the blow notes and one's for the draw notes. And you start with that regular draw note for a bend. But when you bend it, it's actually the blow note reed underneath it kicking in sympathetically and making that note that you're hearing. But you can't even hear the transition between. Okay. So anyway, that's just a weird, freakish thing that somebody figured out, and it spread, and now everyone does it.
Yeah, I wanted to get to the book itself, Kim, and you mentioned certain things that I know Billy Boy encountered when he started learning, and learned some of them from his idol at the time, Sonny Boy Williamson. That was bending the note, which I think Sonny Boy called choking the harp,
right,
and playing in second position, which was new to Billy Boy, and he learned that. And then you mentioned tongue blocking at the time. Yeah. But actually starting the book, and you're the perfect partner with your background as a writer on the instrument and also as a master player now. But in the introduction of the book, you mentioned that the project itself started back in 2015. You were first introduced to Billy Boy at Seattle's Jazz Alley. And can you take it from there? You talk a little bit about that introduction, meeting him and then meeting him again a few years later in Portland at the Alberta Rose Theater.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wrote the harmonica book, like you as you mentioned, in like 95. And then I had a work career and raising kids and playing music. And so I finally retired. And I thought, you know, I'm going to write another book. So, but, you know, what book? Like, exactly. So I was on the prowl. And I have a really good friend, Mark Hummel, who's a really fantastic, one of the top harmonica players today. And he tours regularly with these harmonica showcase bills where he...
The blowouts.
He gets like four or five legendary harmonica players on the same show. And he's done many, many of these. So he came through Seattle one year. And it was perfect because it was a tribute to Sonny Boy Williamson, who is Billy Boy Arnold's big hero. And Billy Boy was on the show. And I had gotten a Billy Boy record of his hits like in college. So I was familiar with Billy Boy's stuff, but I'd never been able to see him live. And it was a great show. And Billy Boy was fantastic. And then Mark had me up on stage with all these guys for this Harmonica Hell finale thing at the end. And I played a little bit. I ran up to the dressing room to thank Mark for having me and popped in there. And Billy Boy was the only guy in the room. and he looked up and he said, "Wow, that was some nice harmonica you played."
Wow.
So I just slid into the seat next to him. And the next thing I knew, we were talking about how he took lessons from John Lee Williamson in 1947 when he was 12 years old. So I ruminated on that for about a year and a half. And I talked to other people and everybody said Billy Boy Arnold has the most amazing personal story. And he has a memory like a steel trap. He remembers, he's over 80, but he remembers everything. So about a year and a half later, Mark brought another blowout troupe through Portland, where I was now living. And Billy Boy was on that show as well. And I called up Mark before they got to town. And I said, "Look, I really would like, I'm going to pitch Billy Boy on this book idea. And could you please reintroduce me to him backstage?" And so Mark did that. And I didn't want to spook Billy Boy with some intense sales pitch, like in the middle of a show, right? But I just said, "Look, I'm a writer and I'm a harmonica player and I'm a huge fan of your music. And I can tell you, I'm a student of the history, and I can tell you, you have a story that no one else can tell. I'm a writer, and maybe, you know, how about I come out to Chicago and we talk a little bit more about that?" And he goes, "Sure." So I had the good sense to call Dick Sherman, who's a legendary Grammy Award winning blues record producer who I knew. He's a Seattle native too. And, I called Dick. I knew he was friends with Billy Boy. And so Dick arranged a three-way lunch for us in Chicago. I flew out there. It turns out Dick is incredibly well connected with Billy Boy. They have a relationship that goes back 40 years. So I started my little sales pitch over lunch, and I got about 20 seconds into this. And Billy Boy just goes, "Well, if Dick says you're cool, you're cool. So like, how does this work? Do you have a tape recorder? Like, when do we start?"
Wow. He was ready.
Yeah. And I had no tape recorder. I was in no way prepared. I was just there to sell him on the idea. So, and then the pandemic hit, and we did the whole thing over the phone. I did about 65, 70 hours of interviews with him over the phone, and then began the laborious chore of transcribing them and then editing them and then arranging it into like a coherent chronological narrative. But the whole thing for me was to put it in Billy Boy's own words. The thing I have to make clear to everyone who's interested in this book is I didn't write the book. I edited it from the tapes of Billy Boy. The book is Billy Boy's own words, just as he said them. I wrote the introduction, and that was it for me. And so my whole goal was to not only capture Billy Boy's amazing story, but to capture his voice and his personality. And I've gotten some pretty good affirmation from people like Dick and other close friends of Billy Boy that I did a pretty good job of that. So that was everything.
Oh, an incredible job. I listened, I don't know Billy Boy, and I've never heard him speak, but I did recently, prepping for the interview. He did some podcasts, one in particular for one called Jazz Beat. And I got to say that the voice that came through, listening to Billy Boy, comes through in the book, on print, on the page. And that's not just his words exactly as transcribed by you, but also his personality. And we talked about this. He seems not just persistent and kind of nothing's going to stop him in terms of making his music, but also a very nice guy. It just really comes across. You get to know him so well.
He's a very nice guy. He's definitely a glass half full kind of guy.
Yes.
And he's very smart, and he has a very inquiring mind. He's interested in a whole range of topics, not just music. He's on top of world events. He's a citizen of the world. He pays attention to things that go on, but he has a special passion that he developed at the age of 5, listening to his aunt's blues 78s. And by the time he was 12, he was using his pin money to start his own record collection. He was a blues fanatic, and he's a very, like you said, he's a very persistent guy. And the person he really zeroed in on record was John Lee Sonny Boy Williamson, who was the first harmonica star in the blues. He's the guy that took the solitary solo piano instrument that you carried in your pocket and put it in the blues context. I mean, the band context. First little string bands that he recorded with down south, and then he moved to Chicago and began to record with more urban combos like piano, drums, and bass and everything. But Sonny Boy created the whole model for blues harmonica. Then Billy Boy, as a 12-year-old, discovered that he thought that if you recorded and made records, you lived in New York or Los Angeles or something. But he found out, he finds out his hero lives in not only Chicago, the same town, but in the same neighborhood, you know, the black neighborhood in the South Side where Billy Boy was born and is being raised. For about a year, he would stop every single person he saw on the street with a guitar case and ask him two questions. Do you know Sonny Boy Williamson? And how do you get to make records? So those are revelatory questions, right? Because he wants to find, he's like Livingston going through darkest Africa trying to find, Stanley trying to find Livingston,
yeah.
And he's very curious about how you make records because he's got kind of an idea that maybe he could contribute to this thing in some way. And so finally, one day he stopped this guy, Lazy Bill Lucas, who's walking down the street with a guitar. And Lazy Bill goes, yeah, I know Sonny Boy. He lives right over on Giles Street. And he gave Billy Boy, Sonny Boy's address. And he ran in and wrote it down before he could forget it. And
in his father's or uncle's butcher shop, it was right there on the corner. Yeah, like a block away from Sonny Boy's house.
Exactly. And so the first time he went by Sonny Boy's place to find out where it was, he was too scared. So he just yelled, "Hey, Sonny Boy," and then ran. But the next time he went back with his cousins on their way back from, they used to go to the movies every Saturday. And on the way home, they would go by Sonny Boy's place. So they just went up and knocked on the door, and this guy opens the door and Billy Boy is the ringleader. He said, we're here to see Sonny Boy Williamson. And the guy goes, well, here I am.
Wow.
And, you know, come on up. And so he invited him up, and he was very tickled, you know, that he had this fanatic little fan. And Billy Boy found out he played a marine band harmonica, because Billy Boy didn't know which harmonica you're supposed to buy. And, you know, got a few other clues and played for him, which gave Sonny Boy a big kick. And he went back a couple weeks later, and he had Billy Boy was armed with a marine band harmonica that he bought, and John Lee gave him some actual tips on how to use your tongue and how to bend a note and that choking thing. And at the end of the visit, Sonny Boy was leaving for a show. He says, hey, that's a brand new marine. Would you mind if I borrowed that marine band for tonight's show? And Billy Boy goes, well, no, of course not. And so he goes down to the street, and Billy Boy gets in a cab with his harmonica. It takes off for the gig. It went back about 3 weeks later, and a woman answered the door, and they said, we're here to talk to Sonny Boy. And she said, oh, didn't you hear? He was murdered just a couple of weeks ago. Sonny Boy was attacked on the way home after a gig That was the official version of the story. Billy Boy has a different version that he believes.
Yeah, I've read that. There's a lot of misinformation, maybe mythology associated with Sonny Boy's death, but Billy Boy's story kind of clarifies it if it is accurate.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm not really here to judge, but he's Billy Boy did hear that story secondhand.
And it was he won big in craps at a gambling joint and then got bashed in the head with a hammer.
He got mugged for the money he'd won in the craps game. And then they just dumped him on his front doorstep, and he managed to knock on the door, and his wife found him there, and he died in the hospital. So here's Billy Boy, this amazing 12-year-old go get him kind of guy. And he meets his hero. His hero turns out to be a great guy, gives him some tips, and then he's dead.
Devastating.
Yeah. It crushed Billy Boy. He still, feels the effects of that, but it didn't stop him. That's the thing about Billy Boy. He got to know Blind John Davis, who was a prominent blues pianist in Chicago, played on a lot of the RCA Victor records. And then through, he became kind of a protege of Blind John. And then through Blind John, he met Big Bill Brunzi and Memphis Minnie. The thing that makes Billy Boy so unique is that people think the Chicago blues sound, the legendary sound, started in the early 50s when Muddy Waters and Little Walter and Howlin' Wolf and those people amplified the country blues that they brought with them from the Delta. But actually, the Chicago blues goes way back to the beginning of recordings in the 20s. And Billy Boy met Sonny Boy and Blind John Davis and Big Bill Brunzi and Memphis Minnie and these people from that previous era of Chicago blues. So Billy Boy spans the entire history of Chicago blues in one lifetime, one person. And because he's been on the scene since he was 12. And he's 86 now. And again, like I said, he literally remembers everything. It's unbelievable.
Even though that was, like I said, devastating for Billy Boy to hear that Sonny Boy had died, when his widow answered the door, she actually told Billy Boy, "You're not in the blues world until you make a record," which seemed to inspire him. So he set about making one, and he made his first record for Cool Records, a local, I guess, Chicago company. Released in 1953, interesting, is a 78, and at that time the 45 was a new format. It was released in that format too, but apparently there was a surprise in store that changed his life quite a bit when he picked up copies at the record company.
Oh yeah, he was, you know, William or Billy Arnold, and he got his copy of the record, and the record was by Billy Boy.
Which he didn't care for at first.
No, he thought it was a diminutive, and he was 17, so he was obsessed with appearing older, right? And he thought that was really weird. I mean, he couldn't do anything about it. The record was out. But he ended up, you know, he's known as Billy Boy Arnold today, so it stuck with him.
And then he started playing with a guy named Ellis McDaniel. And Ellis's band, The Hipsters, in Chicago clubs. And based on his own experience with the record companies there, he was instrumental in getting Ellis McDaniel his first record in 1955. I think you know where I'm going. It turned out to be an incredible debut. Can you tell us about Billy Boy's role in that legendary recording? And of course, his influence on the career of Ellis McDaniel, who not only got a hit record out of it, but a new name.
Yeah, he got a new moniker too. So, he meets Ellis on the street, playing on the street when he's about 15 and Ellis is about 20, so early 20s. And they play on the street off and on for a couple of years. And then Ellis calls Billy Boy and said, I'm putting together a band and I want to play the clubs. I want to, you know, go more pro here. And I want you to be in the band. So Billy Boy does that. And they start playing the clubs. And Billy Boy is, again, he's very interested in making a record because he thinks that's how you become a real professional is to have a record out there. So he talks to Ellis about this. Ellis isn't really, according to Billy Boy, isn't super ambitious or, you know, necessarily interested in recording. But he does have a recording, an acetate machine in his apartment. Ellis turns out to be this electronics amateur kind of genius. And he's got his own acetate machine in his apartment, so he can cut his own records, his own, shellac records. So he cuts a demo of some fragments of tunes that he's got. And so Billy Boy goes, okay, we're going to the record companies. We're going to take this demo around. And they go to all the Chicago blues labels, VJ and all kinds of labels. And they end up going across, after VJ, they go across the street to Chess. And Billy Boy had met Phil Chess, who's Leonard and Phil Chess were the owners. And they walked in and providentially Phil was there, and Phil remembered Billy Boy. And so he said, okay, let's listen to your dub. And they listened to it. And Phil said, you know, I want my brother Leonard to hear this. So can you come back tomorrow when he's here and play it for him? And they said, sure. So they did that. One of the songs fragments that was on the demo was like, Ellis had built his own guitar pickup to put into an acoustic guitar. And he had this weird flange kind of sound that he got out of it. And he had this interesting rhythm that was very different. It was, you know, bump, 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 the shave and a haircut.
Right. Was that called the Hambone groove or something?
Yeah.
Like?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so Leonard had big ears, and he wasn't just, you know, obsessed with the blues. You know, he's the one that also discovered a year later Chuck Berry and so forth. So he was interested in new sounds, and there was definitely a new sound here on this demo. So he rehearsed them and finally put together a recording session, and they got into the recording studio with Leonard Chess, and Leonard got really frustrated because they didn't have a song. They just had these little fragments of things, and they had no lyrics. There was no beginning. There was no end. And so Leonard Chess personally worked with them for like a couple of hours, and they wrote verses and, you know, figured out a beginning and an ending. And when they recorded it, when Leonard wanted Ellis to sing, he would point at his mouth, and we wanted to play guitar, he would point to his guitar for his time for the solo. And he just pulled this song out of them. Then the record came out, and it wasn't by Ellis McDaniels and the Hipsters. It was by, the song was called Bo Diddley, which was actually something from a verse that they wrote on the spot. And Billy Boy claims that he's the one that came up with that term, Bo Diddley. And so the song ends up being titled Bo Diddley, and the artist is Bo Diddley. So the record is Bo Diddley by Bo Diddley.
Oh, I love that story in the book. And I just want to add, Kim, Billy Boy claimed that he had heard the name Bo Diddley on the street, and he thought it was the funniest thing he ever heard. It turned out that Bo Diddley was a short, bow-legged comedian who played at the local Indiana theater. They had, instead of movies on Saturday nights, they had a midnight ramble with music and, I guess, comedy. And just in the studio, Billy Boy just said, well, why don't we use Bo Diddley for the lyrics? Because it just sounded funny. And it turned out to be the name of the song. And then this Ellis McDaniel's new name. And he became this big, big blues rock star.
Yeah. And Leonard Chess was a little dubious when he came up with the Bo Diddley thing. He goes, what does that mean? Because he didn't want anything like dirty that he didn't know about, like to slip into the record. So they had to explain that it was the name of the stage name of this black midget comedian in Chicago. But so that's how the Bo Diddley, the song and the artist Bo Diddley came about. It's a pretty amazing story. And Billy Boy also has some very interesting things to say just about Leonard Chess in general, and the Chess label, which was a white owned label. There were black owned labels like VJ, who were also successful in Chicago. And Billy Boy says the thing that really differentiated Leonard Chess was his passion and commitment to putting out good quality records. And he, you know, spent a lot of time in the studio with the artist. And Billy Boy also claims that Leonard had a long range view of these, his artists' careers. He wanted to, you know, keep them successful because he was successful thereby too, right? In terms of selling those records. So that he compares Leonard's long range view and his creative control with some pretty slapdash attitudes and get the money quick and run kind of attitudes from some of the other labels in Chicago. So
like Lester Melrose, he goes into two who didn't pay royalties, probably was not as dedicated to the music as Leonard Chess was, but still instrumental in getting the word out, getting these things recorded. Again, he's that glass half full guy, so he doesn't really put down Lester Melrose, but I think he accurately describes the difference between Melrose and Chess, though both of them were kind of a little lax on the financial accounting and certainly paying royalties until Leonard Chess started dealing with bigger names like Howlin' Wolf, I guess, and Chuck Berry, as you mentioned, and had to pay the royalties to keep these guys on his label.
Yeah, I think, you know, frankly, the record business in those days was pretty piratical and kind of beyond the arm of the law and so forth. And the accounting was very questionable, like even for Leonard Chess and Lester Melrose. His genius was actually he collected the copyrights on the songs. He got the songwriting publishing. He understood publishing and that's actually anytime anybody records that song, the publisher makes money. So Lester Melrose ended up holding the publishing rights for like 3,000 songs or something. And Leonard Chess didn't do too much of that, but he had his own publishing company. So it's a very mixed bag. If you just only look at the history of recording from a moral standpoint or a legal standpoint, it's just one long, sad story, kind of.
Yes, probably still that way today. I know that's true with people, actors and writers on movies. Very strange accounting. But more on Leonard Chess, and I learned so much about him from the book, from Billy Boy's recounting. And there's two things that stand out besides the Bo Diddley session, where, as you mentioned, he actually directed Ellis and a.k.a. Bo Diddley on when to sing, when to play guitar. Before that, about 3 years, he released a little Walter Jacobs record called Juke, and it was instrumental. And he wasn't quite sure about it when he recorded it, but apparently he was playing it back in Chess Studios, and there was a woman outside waiting for a bus. And every time he played it, and she must have heard it, she started dancing. When he stopped playing it, she stopped dancing. When he put it back on again, she started dancing. He knew what people wanted, and he had ways of finding that out. And then there was another story a little later in the book where he changed. He had Chuck Berry recording for him. Chuck Berry came in with a song called Ida Red, and Leonard Chess suggested he change the title to Maybelline. Chuck Berry was a guitar player. He didn't intend to sing the song, but Leonard Chess said, Chuck, why don't you give it a try and sing it? And look at this guy's career. I mean, pretty much the father of rock and roll in a lot of ways.
Yeah, Leonard Chess had really great instincts. There's no doubt about it. And he had an open mind. He was open to new ideas and new sounds, and he kind of went for it. There's another session with Muddy Waters where they were doing kind of a stop time Willie Dixon song, I think, and a kind of a really moody thing. And the drummer couldn't really get it. It wasn't working. And so Leonard Chess pushed him aside and sat down behind the drums. It was basically he's just playing the bass drum pedal on this song, really. But it's Leonard Chess playing the bass drum on that song because the other guy couldn't get it. But Leonard pounded it out. So he was a very hands-on guy, a very interesting personality for sure.
And you get a real taste. Billy Boy doesn't talk about it specifically or make a big deal out of it, but of the racial relations there in Chicago, which are a lot better than where a lot of the black musicians came from, including Billy Boy's family from the South, where they had racism and the Jim Crow laws and also the economics for them, in terms of job opportunities and getting paid were nowhere as good as in Chicago, which weren't the best anyway.
Right.
And then he writes about their view of the blues at the time. And I think Billy Boy's dad referred to it as a cabbage music or something derisively. And so the black audience, I guess, associated it a lot with the South and they kind of put it down. It wasn't as sophisticated, say, as jazz or some other things. until, and this was again in Billy Boy's words, there were black crossover artists in the 50s, Fats Domino, Bo Diddley, Chuck Berry, who we mentioned, but also white musicians who came onto the Chicago scene, Paul Butterfield, Elvin Bishop, Charlie Musselwhite, who you know, Kim. And in the book, when they started playing it, Billy Boy says that the black audience started taking it a little bit more seriously. So it was not only good for the music, but also the black musicians played for white audiences and they got paid more because the white clubs gave them a little bit more money than the black clubs did. I guess they had more affluent patrons.
Yeah, this is kind of the second half of Billy Boy's amazing story because, you know, he goes back to 1947 and, you know, starting to play with these guys. But then he's around when Chess comes out, Muddy Waters and Little Walter hit the scene. And then he's part of that because right after the Bo Diddley record, Billy Boy cut his own record for VJ called I Wish You Would, which also became a hit. So he had a hit record by the age of 19 and was forced to become a band leader because you got to play behind your record, right? And then he did that for the rest of his life. But then when Billy Boy was a kid, they all laughed at him. All his peers listened to Billy Eckstine and Sarah Vaughan and the Orioles and the doo-wop groups, and they laughed at him for being a blues fan. And I was really wrestling with what to call this book, you know, and I was going back over this one tape, and he was talking about he had this dream when he was 12, like 14 or 15, like you do, right? If I had $1 million, what would I do? And his dream was to, he would pay John Lee Hooker and Muddy Waters $25,000 to do a show. And then he would buy them all nice homes to live in. And the blues would break out and not only get popular in, you know, but with white audiences, but in other country, all over the world. And they thought he was insane. And then he just laughs on the tape and he's like, and it happened exactly the way I dreamed it.
Yeah, and his model apparently were the classical composers of the 17th and 18th centuries, where people like Mozart and Beethoven had commissions. And that's what Billy Boy suggested for the great blues artists of the time.
And so, but then in the late 50s, the blues started really tailing off with the black audiences in Chicago and everywhere, really. And things got tough. And then these white musicians started showing up in the clubs on the South Side, Nick Gravanites, Paul Butterfield, Charlie Musselwhite, Elvin Bishop. To Billy Boy, this made perfect sense. This was the start. This is part of his dream. It shocked a lot of black audiences in the clubs at first, but when they saw that these guys could actually play and sing and clearly had a reverence for the music, they got more used to it. And the prominent player band leaders like Muddy and the Wolf were very supportive in a kind of limited way. And so then Butterfield starts getting the black band bluesmen gigs on the north side of Chicago, which is the white side of Chicago around the University of Chicago. And it takes off like gangbusters. It becomes this huge draw. And Butterfield gets signed to Elektra Records. And Billy Boy Arnold's brother, Jerome, is Paul Butterfield's bass player.
Bass player, yeah.
So when Butterfield started going out of town on the weekends to tour, he would turn over his house gig at Big John's, this club on the north side, to people like Billy Boy or Buddy Guy and Junior Wells. And that's how they started playing for white audiences in Chicago. And then that led to, you know, the transition of the blues audience from urban blacks primarily to white college students. And so that's a whole other unbelievable part of Billy Boy's story. But he was very close with Charlie Musselwhite and Butterfield. And so, he has some very interesting things to say about that whole transition. And as you mentioned, they were all for it. I mean, they didn't make money comparative to, you know, other successful pop stars, but compared to the money they were making in the black clubs in the South Side, they made a lot more money playing for white audiences. And, that certainly speaks to musicians. And so it was a positive thing, a little bit confusing at times, but definitely positive.
And then a few years later, in the early 60s, you had the British groups, the English groups, embrace the blues. I think all rock fans know that. And there was even one group, the Yardbirds, with Eric Clapton on guitar that covered Billy Boy's song, which he recorded years earlier, I Wish You Would. And you even have an Eric Clapton, a blurb on the cover of the book, which is amazing. I think the Animals covered a Billy Boy song. Billy Boy mentioned, again, there were no royalties for him, but he didn't blame the musicians. He blamed the record companies who knew where that was coming from.
Billy Boy had no idea. Like, the first two records Eric Clapton ever played on were Billy Boy and Arnold covers with the Yardbirds. And Billy Boy starts to tour Europe in the late 70s and finds out that all these bands are playing his material. And in fact, those Yardbirds singles were hits. And he went back and tried to recoup his royalties from Conrad Music, which is the publishing wing of VJ Records that he recorded that song for. And he made a little bit of money, but it was pathetic. And he never saw the financial benefit for that. But he also admits that it may help make a reputation for him over in Europe. And, he's toured over there quite a bit.
So when the Yardbirds and the Animals recorded those songs, Billy Boy was never contacted for rights? Or
That's an important point, because Billy Boy's not angry at Eric Clapton or the Yardbirds, because they paid their publishing fees. They paid for the right to do that song, and they paid Conrad Music.
Oh, okay. Just the wrong person. Yeah.
Yeah. The publishing company for VJ. But unfortunately, VJ had gone bankrupt. There was no records even of Conrad publishing. It was just a nightmare. And Billy Boy, Gene Goodman, Benny Goodman's brother, the famous jazz player, he and Leonard Chess had a publishing company called Arc Music, and they bought the Conrad publishing rights, but they had no paperwork. They claimed they couldn't tell Billy Boy how many copies had been sold. And so they gave him a one-time kind of meager payoff, but that's it. But again, it did help spread.
It got his music out there
to
a wide audience. Now, we have to talk about Billy Boy's favorite harmonica player. And I don't know, Kim, if he's yours also, Little Walter Jacobs. Billy Boy said he considers him the greatest harmonica player of all time. And as you talked about a little earlier, he was a pioneer on the amplified harp. I read up on him, and he was the first musician apparently to purposely use electronic distortion, which becomes such a big part of rock music. Can you talk a little bit about Little Walter, his influence on Billy Boy and maybe on you too and all harmonica players?
Well, Little Walter is, if you're a novelist, James Joyce is kind of a big conundrum. Like, what are you going to do after that guy, right?
Ah.
And Little Walter's the James Joyce of blues harmonica. It's like, what's left to do, kind of. And he started out as a John Lee Williamson disciple, very much adopted John Lee Williamson's model for how to play harmonica on a blues tune. And but then Little Walter was younger. He smoked marijuana, whereas the other guys were all hardcore, like whiskey drinkers. And he listened to a lot of jazz and a lot of jazz saxophone in particular. And so he put that thing into blues harp and just rewrote the whole book. And Billy Boy is nothing less than a harp fanatic. And he was fanatical about John Lee Williamson. But when he first heard Little Walter, like a few years later in the early 50s, he knew he was the guy, and he switched allegiances. And Sonny Boy was dead by then. Little Walter's, contribution and place in the hierarchy just can't even be exaggerated. He's just, I've been listening to that guy every day for 60 years, and it's just, I still hear new things in there. His sonic effects in the studios, the Sun records that you mentioned, like Rocket 88, were some of the rawest, like, frankly, poorly recorded record.
Yes, that was early in the 50s.
But Chess, as part of his commitment to quality, he didn't build his own studio until 1964. He used Universal Studios in Chicago, which was one of the biggest recording studios in the country. He typically went in late at night to pay the after hours, cheaper rates. But Bill Putnam was the chief engineer there, and Bill went on to found to build all the studios and Capitol Records in the Capitol Records building in LA and became Frank Sinatra's chief engineer. So the Chess records are really good quality. And a lot of that use of reverb and certain little sonic tricks was really not Little Walter. It was Walter was playing through an amp, which was, he figured out how to do that in the best possible way and figured out what the possibilities of playing amplified harp were versus, you know, acoustic. But a lot of the echo stuff, that's all handled by Bill Putnam and the guys behind the board, you know. So like Charlie Christian came along and became the first electric guitar kind of genius. And he understood that the electric guitar enabled you to hit notes with lots of sustain and to be heard in ways that were just impossible with acoustic guitar. And Little Walter figured out the same sensibilities on the harmonica, like long swooping notes and things like that, that wouldn't be necessarily quite so powerful acoustic, but you put that through an amplifier and it's really something.
And when you mentioned Bill Putnam, Kim, I should let the listeners know that what you have included is some footnotes, which are short bios on a lot of the people that Billy Boy mentions, including Bill Putnam. So that's how I learned a lot about him. And that adds a lot to the book, some good background. I mean, I also had the phone out Googling a few things just because there's so much detail in there and you just want to learn more about certain musicians, about the producers, the recording engineers, what went on in Chicago, the South Side and the West Side and the Black neighborhoods at that time. And you mentioned the North Side, which was more of a white Chicago.
Yeah, like I worked hard to like get out of Billy Boy. Like, what was it like to go to a Black club in 1955? You know, like, how did it work? Like, what were the audiences like? Was it as violent as I've heard, you know? And the fact that like they all played sitting down back in those days, like just details like that. And when you walked into a bar, you didn't buy it by the drink. You bought a setup. And so you bought a quarter pint with four people and a bucket of ice and some glasses. And then, you know, you ordered another one after that. And yes, it was very violent in the clubs and things like that. So I really tried. And there's a lot about Chicago, like what the redlining led to in Chicago between, you know, the real estate redlining that kept whites and blacks segregated, you know, that kind of thing. And then Billy Boy, he's an urbanite. He's born in Chicago. He goes to the South for the first time because he's got a hit record and he goes on tour with Howlin' Wolf and Fats Domino and experiences race, you know, hardcore racism in the South for the first time. And that's a very interesting part of the book too.
Yeah, he talks about a trip to Dallas where I guess they had separate hotel restaurants. If they were allowed in at all, they had to come in through the back, through the kitchen.
He couldn't get a cab. He was stunned, you know, like that didn't, there was all kinds of prejudice in Chicago, but in terms of services and things like that, I mean, they all went, you could go to the same theaters and, you know, you could all get taxi cabs and that kind of a thing. Eat at the same restaurants if you.
Now the book, again, it's the blues dream of Billy Boy Arnold. And it came true, as you said, Kim. It's kind of an Horatio Alger story, but not the traditional rags to riches, more like rags to records. And Billy Boy made quite a few. And you include a very helpful discography in the book. Billy Boy shares towards the end what he learned about doing those recordings. I just wanted to mention these three things that's on his list. When you make a record, the artist has to be in total control. You have to write your own songs. You have to have your own sound, which seems like timeless advice. And hopefully Billy Boy's story inspires young musicians today to pursue their own dreams. I was wondering, Kim, have you received any feedback from those younger musicians maybe coming up in the blues, jazz, rock world, harmonica players especially, after they read the book, what they thought about it?
Yeah, I have. It's I think, you know, if the book does anything, I want it to, you know, create more interest in Billy Boy's music. I want people to buy his records and you know, search him out and listen to his sound. I think most of the younger people didn't really realize about that earlier period before Muddy Waters in Chicago. So that's been a little bit of a revelation, I think, for them as they read the book. I think the book is sort of a universe, could be The book can appeal to anybody. Like, you don't have to be a blues fanatic to appreciate this book because Billy Boy's personality comes through so strongly. He's just a very interesting guy, and the book is structured in such a way that it's like you're sitting there talking with him.
You know? You're not only that, but I think you're right there in the scene. The details are amazing. I mean, not just the street addresses, but you get the sights, the sounds, the smells, what it was like to live in Chicago in that era.
Yeah, and he, like most urbanites, he snaps to the grid when he tells a story. Like if you talk to a New Yorker, they go, "Well, I was on Third Avenue in Lexington."
Right.
And he mentions all these addresses and street corners that he still remembers like 50 years later, 60, 70 years later. So there were so many of those references that I worked with a local artist here in Portland, Fred Ingram, who's a great drummer, actually.
Ah, too. The maps.
Uh-huh. And we created these maps at the last minute. We barely got them in on the deadline. But I've gotten so many compliments about that because they're basically maps of the Black neighborhoods in the South Side and the West Side with the locations of all the spots that Billy Boy mentions in the book. And what really strikes home is like, this is one neighborhood in one city, and almost every blues record you know about.
Right. What, the Golden Triangle.
You can't even conceive of the concentration of talent. And they all came from a 200-mile radius section of Mississippi, originally, most of them.
And yeah, around Clarksdale.
Yeah, it's just like there's never been anything like such a concentration of talent in one small place that like there is in the blues. It's hard to even comprehend.
Now, Kim, you're a working musician yourself as a singer and harmonica player, and you have your own band here in Portland, The Perfect Gentleman. Do you guys cover any Billy Boy songs in your shows?
We sure do. Yeah, we do. I Wish You Would, every night. And then there's a couple of other ones. We just, a couple of others that we do less often. But I make sure we do that every night.
And before we go, Kim, how can people find out more about the book and also all the upcoming shows, not just Kim Field and The Perfect Gentleman, but you mentioned you have maybe some harmonica workshops planned for the new year?
Oh, yeah, thanks. Well, you know, the book is available through all the normal channels. If you're a Portlander, I got my copy through Powell's, so you can do that as well. But, of course, it's on Amazon. And if you have some issues with Amazon as a fulfillment spot, you can go to bookshelf.org, which is a nice alternative to Amazon. It's a consortium of independent publishers. Rather than a huge corporation behind it.
Or check the publisher. It's University of Chicago is the publisher, a big publisher.
Right. University of Chicago Press. So it's that they're probably the largest independent or academic press in the world, I think. And then my band, The Perfect Gentleman, we play, you know, we have a Facebook page, but we play we have a regular first Fridays of every month at a really cool venue called Strum here in town in Portland, but you can follow us on Facebook. And then, last summer I was talked into giving a harmonica workshop, a 3-day workshop at this beautiful location called the Manuka Conference Center out in the Gorge. And it's an old estate, 200 acres with a spectacular view upriver and downriver, about 800 feet above the gorge. And I got some of the best harmonica instructors in the world to come out for 3 days last fall. And we had a really great event. And so we'll be doing that again in October of 23. And manuka.org will give you more details about that. But it'd be great to see more folks at the gig, and be sure and introduce yourself.
And I know at last year's Waterfront Blues Festival, which was the first kind of live in-person one they had in the past few years because of the pandemic, you were running the harmonica blowout on the front porch stage in the back. Right. Do you plan to do that again in 2023?
I just talked to the festival, and I will be hosting the harmonica blow-off again this summer. It's always on July 4th. And I think there's some opportunities to make some other appearances at the festival too. So more on that later.
Okay. We'll stay tuned. Well, Kim, thanks so much for joining us today and for all you do as a writer and musician to keep the spirit of the blues alive and well.
And thanks to you and the station, too, for everything you do for the music. And I really appreciate you having me on today.
Oh, great. Thanks, Kim.
All right. Take care.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, I would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it, if we had a director. You can listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Kim Field, writer, musician, and co-author of the book, The Blues Dream, A Billy Boy Arnold, from the University of Chicago Press. You can find out more about the book, all of Kim's work, his band, The Perfect Gentleman, and his upcoming events online at kimfield.com. The KBOO program Words and Pictures, which usually airs at this time from 11:30 to noon, generously gave us their slot today so we could spend the whole hour with Kim and Billy Boy. Words and Pictures, along with host S.W. Conser, will be back at its usual time on Thursday, February 23rd at 11:30 a.m. We'll be back again, too, that very day at 11 a.m. Hope to see you then. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying...
Crying and pleading ain't doing no good.